The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So this morning I'd like to talk about being willing to not know. What do you do when you don't know what to do? And I thought back over my own life, times that I've had difficulties in the workplace where someone else and I were not seeing eye to eye on how something should be done. Clearly, some decision had to be made. It wasn't working. And I just was at my wit's end. I didn't know what to do. In my own life, raising a child, you know, when you have a teenager, or when you were a teenager, there are all kinds of crises that arise, some of them based in reality, some not. But I can remember the feeling, I don't know what to do. I can remember when I had a very small baby who wouldn't stop crying. I had no idea what to do. I knew nothing about babies. I don't know what to do. In that case, I called my mother. She knew what to do. But what we mean when we say, I don't know what to do, is actually, I can't figure out what to do. I'm thinking all the thoughts I can possibly muster, but I can't think of a solution to whatever the situation is that I find myself in. And it doesn't feel good to be in that place. We feel helpless. We can feel completely vulnerable. We can feel trapped. Sometimes I don't know what to do. Feels like the walls are closing in and there's nowhere to go. And there you are, just trapped in, I don't know what to do. That kind of discomfort, quite commonly, will rather, you know, if not sooner than later, express itself in emotions. Feelings of fear, feelings of anger, feelings of frustration, grief, despair. And all those are really powerful. And when we get those chemicals going in our body, they like to prompt us into some kind of action. Anything. I'll do anything just to get out of this trap that I'm in. And of course, we all know that anything we do that's informed by our anger or our fear or our despair is usually not necessarily a wise choice. But it's there. And for a lot of us, we have very well-worn paths of action that we have built up over the years by trying to escape from that kind of sensation. And one of the problems is that when we do something like that, we actually think that what we're doing is going to fix the problem. Because that's, you know, I don't know what to do. Well, you know, if I scream loud enough at you, perhaps you'll get it, you know, whatever. we think we're doing the right thing. And who knows, maybe it even works sometime. But it just builds up the one thing that's really kind of dangerous, and that is those kinds of habits of moving along that path of emotion to action. Actually, when we're in those kinds of situations, according to our own definitions, we've suddenly found ourselves not in control of a situation. And, you know, this little person who lives in here and is feeling vulnerable and frightened and angry and all of that does not like being out of control. Now, interestingly enough, I was thinking about control in kind of a broader sense than just this specific instance of not being in control because we don't know what to do. It actually gets much, much wider than that, and feeling not in control for many of us is actually what brought us in the door here. Because we like to be in control of our lives. We like to have things stay safe and secure and predictable and all of those things. Now, sometimes it works that despite all our best efforts, the conditions we find ourselves in, our lives are out of control. You know, all kinds of things are happening. You know, we lose our jobs, we have automobile accidents, loved ones become ill, all kinds of things that if we're trying to create kind of like the designer life for ourselves, we normally don't take into account that those are part of the pieces on the table. We just pick all the other ones, you know. The ones that fit in nice and smooth. Now, there are also some of us who do the same thing, and it actually works, you know. Our life is going along pretty smoothly. You know, nothing dramatic is happening, and pretty much what we had hoped is working out, except for one thing, and that is this feeling that what we hope is the end result of the perfect designer life, you know, peace, contentment, all of those things, there's something missing. And you can't look at your life and say, well, you know, I should change my job, I should change my husband, I should move my house, you know. Something is just not what you had hoped would be there. And in both these situations, for many people, religion is the place to turn to solve both of those kinds of problems. Now, a few weeks ago, after I'd been thinking about talking about this, I happened to be down in Chico at the Dharma Center. I was just in their library, and I saw a book lying there on top, and it had an interesting title. It wasn't really a Buddhist book, although you'd probably find it in the spiritual section of a bookstore. But looking at the title, you know, you kind of wonder what could be on the inside that went with that title. And you know how you just kind of riffle, which is all I was doing. And something caught my eye, and I stopped right there, and I read that chapter. And then I borrowed the book and brought it back because I thought, this is a beautiful example. Now, this is not a Buddhist book, but it's also not written by someone who's a Christian, despite the way the language sounds. But it's someone, it's written by a woman who at the time of these events was, I think, about 30 years old. Been married for 6 years. Her career as a writer was booming. She'd been married for 6 years, and she and her husband had recently found their dream house somewhere outside New York City while still being able to maintain the little apartment in the city, you know, for extra. Everything was going smoothly. And they were approaching 30 years of age, and they decided that when they got to be about in their early 30s, they'd be ready to start a family. Well, gradually she began realizing that things were getting kind of rocky in the marriage, and she was discovering that the thought of having children was enough to send her into a panic. So gradually, you know, her life is starting to crumble. So the piece I'm going to read you was written when things were kind of on the downhill slope. She'd been in kind of a state of despair for quite some time. And this is what happened to her. She ended up in the middle of the night on her bathroom floor, just kind of sobbing her guts out. And she said, In the middle of that dark November crisis, though, I was not interested in formulating my views on theology. I was interested only in saving my life. I had finally noticed that I seemed to have reached a state of hopeless and life-threatening despair, and it occurred to me that sometimes people in this state will approach God for help. I think I'd read that in a book somewhere. So, but she's, you know, this is the last straw. So what happens, you know, when everything else fails? Well, then you think of God. What I said to God through my gasping sobs was something like this. I'm Liz. It's nice to meet you. That's right. I was speaking to the creator of the universe as though we'd just been introduced at a cocktail party. But we work with what we know in this life, and these are the words that she was familiar with when with someone new. I'm sorry to bother you so late at night, I continued, but I'm in serious trouble, and I'm sorry I haven't ever spoken directly to you before, but I do hope I have always expressed ample gratitude for all the blessings that you've given me in my life. Now that's something, to recognize that in this life that's falling apart, was filled with blessings. This thought caused me to sob even harder. God waited me out. I pulled myself together enough to go on. I am not an expert in praying, as you know, but can you please help me? I am in desperate need of help. I don't know what to do. I need an answer. Please tell me what to do. Please tell me what to do. Please tell me what to do. And so the prayer narrowed itself down to that simple entreaty. Please tell me what to do, repeated again and again. I don't know how many times I begged. I only know that I begged like someone who was pleading for her life, and the crying went on forever. Until, quite abruptly, it stopped. Quite abruptly, I found that I was not crying anymore. I'd stopped crying, in fact, mid-sob. My misery had been completely vacuumed out of me. I lifted my forehead off the floor and sat up in surprise, wondering if I would now see some great being who had taken my weeping away. But nobody was there. I was just alone. But not really alone, either. I was surrounded by something I can only describe as a little pocket of silence, a silence so rare that I didn't want to exhale for fear of scaring it off. I was seamlessly still. I don't know when I'd ever felt such stillness. Familiar place, isn't it? Then I heard a voice, and please don't be alarmed. It was not an Old Testament Hollywood Charlton Heston voice, nor was it a voice telling me I must build a baseball field in my backyard. It was merely my own voice, speaking from within my own self. But this was my voice as I had never heard it before. This was my voice, but perfectly wise, calm, and compassionate. This was what my voice would sound like if I'd only ever experienced love and certainty in my life. How can I describe the warmth of affection in that voice as it gave me the answer that would forever seal my faith? The voice said, "Go back to bed, Liz." I exhaled. It was so immediately clear that this was the only thing to do. I would not have accepted any other answer. I would have not trusted a great booming voice that said, "You must divorce your husband." Because that's not true wisdom. True wisdom gives the only possible answer at any given moment, and that night, going back to bed, was the only possible answer. "Go back to bed," said this omniscient interior voice, "because you don't need to know the final answer right now at 3 o'clock in the morning on a Thursday in November. Go back to bed. Go back to bed because the only thing you need to do for now is get some rest and take good care of yourself until you do know the answer. Go back to bed so that if a tempest comes, you'll be strong enough to deal with it. And the tempest is coming, dear one, very soon, but not tonight. Go back to bed." Now, this was her experience. I'm sure that for all of us, you know, it would sound completely different if we were to write experiences that we have had in going to the place that's full of stillness and quiet and tapping into the wisdom that's already there. Clearly this was new to her, and, you know, I haven't read the rest of the book, so I don't know what she did out of all of this, but there's a lot of book left, so I'm suspecting that it goes quite a long way. In Buddhism, you see lots of references to the mind, sometimes the heart mind. And the mind that we're used to is the mind that's familiar with knowledge. It comes up with solutions, it likes facts, it controls things. That's the mind that says, I can figure this out. The heart mind is the mind that understands. It's the mind that experiences. It's the mind of wisdom. The head mind, if you want to call it that, can know all about gratitude, can write definitions, sentences using it, and know how to use the word appropriately. But the head mind has never experienced gratitude. And so the mind that experiences gratitude is the mind of wisdom, is the mind that told Liz, you know, to go back to bed. She had no idea that that mind was there until that time. It's familiar to those of us who have been sitting here hearing Dharma talks over the years or reading. It's the mind that is active in that place of silence that we find in meditation. Great Master Hakuin said this. He says, all people, the old and the young, the high and the low, priests and lay people, wise and otherwise, are endowed with the wonderful virtue of Buddha wisdom. It is present without any lack in all of them. Not one among them, or even half of one, is to be cast aside and rejected because he is a beginner. And so what he's telling us is what we've heard many, many times, that we already have. So guard well, as the scripture says. We have that heart mind. We have that Buddha wisdom. Complete, indestructible, perfect, just as it is. I took a peek into a book I haven't read in a long, long time, but it's written by a medieval Christian monastic, I believe. I got it because I love the title, but it's called The Cloud of Unknowing. No one knows who wrote it, but it's a perfect way of looking at the mind that is willing to not know. And in that book, in the beginning, he says that there are two minds, very familiar to Buddhists. He says that there is the knowing mind and there is the loving mind. And that you find God, because he's writing from the Christian context, God is found by the loving mind. He describes the cloud of unknowing as being a dark place, not a scary dark place, but a dark place where you don't see. You know. In the way that the knowing mind can never know. Now, I think the question that I would ask, I ask myself, I ask all of you, can we be willing to trust what we know is open to us, available to us from our own innate Buddha wisdom, can be we be willing to trust that and to stop trying to figure things out in places where you can't figure it out? Can we be willing to not know? Can we be willing to just ask the question but not know the answer? And just see what happens. Can we be willing to try to sit out our emotions and not let them tell us what's the right thing to do? Can we be willing to sit with the discomfort that's going to arise if we say yes to the previous two questions? Because it's not going to be comfortable. And the question is, how do we begin to actually learn to trust and live with the innate Buddha wisdom that we have? And of course, the thing that immediately comes to mind is we have to begin working on everything in our life that stops us from seeing it. You know, and what is it that stops us from seeing it? It's all of that other stuff. It's the fear, it's the despair, it's the unwillingness to just allow things to be there. And fortunately for us, the religion that we have chosen to help us answer the question of "I don't know what to do" provides a very nice path to follow. It's described in different ways, and today I'm just going to talk in terms of meditation and precepts. Great Master Dogen tells us in rules for meditation, that we are to withdraw within and reflect upon ourselves. So we practice regularly, every day, twice a day if we can do it. We practice every day consciously moving toward that place of stillness that Liz found on the bathroom floor. Because we know that you don't need to be in the midst of crisis to find it. As a matter of fact, if you practice going there on a regular basis, when the crisis comes, you'll be there already. Saves a lot of time. Grief, tears, all of that, you'll be there. Not that it'll be all easy, but we'll be there. We're in the good starting spot. When we sit in that stillness, one of the things that we can notice is the mind busy trying to figure things out. We sit there trying to figure out why we got upset about something, why we burned the potatoes, why all of these kinds of things. But the mind is going, and we can sit and we can watch it do that. We become very familiar with that. We also get a lot of practice sitting still in the midst of feeling uncomfortable, unpleasant, unhappy, distressed, you name it, the list would go around the block. But we have practice learning to sit still when all of that is raging. As we go on and on with our meditation, we get more and more skilled at seeing things for what they are, not for what they appear to be or what we think they might be. If someone says something and we have become incredibly upset about it and self-righteous and whatever, we can learn to see that in fact what happened was some person opened their mouth and noise came out. That's all it was noise. And, we're kind of building the rest of our evening on replaying that sound in our own ears. But it was noise. That's all it was. And we learn to get ourselves out of the way. You know, we learn to know that there's something more than just what we're experiencing at any given time. There's something much, much more. Now, paired with our daily time that we spend cultivating the stillness within ourselves, we also practice the precepts. And if we do practice them wholeheartedly, we're doing the kind of work that needs to be done so that we can walk through the world being as harmless as we know how to be. And if we're harmless, a lot of the things that stir us up, that we're finding coming up as we're sitting on the cushion, won't be happening so often. We won't be harming people. I mean, imagine if just taking one, imagine if we could completely stop speaking against other people. You know, because if I tell you the latest dirt on somebody, you'll tell somebody else, you know, and on it goes. Think of how the web shrinks. So we become more harmless. And somehow, as a result of sitting and of working with the precepts, wisdom begins to arise. Doesn't mean we're creating it. It means the cloud is getting thinner. We're able to see more. We're able to respond differently to the question, I don't know what to do. You know, please tell me what to do. We're beginning to be able to allow the Buddha wisdom to actually be able to offer us something without having to wave an arm through all of the clouds of emotion and all of that we habitually put there. Now, the wisdom, of course, isn't ours. So we aren't developing a new skill or anything like that. This is just something that just is. It's always been there, always will. But we need to establish different conditions in our life in order to be able to see it. Great Master Dogen in Genjo Koan said the following. I like this so much, this sits in my room. I look at it every day. And you've heard it many times, perhaps. When one studies Buddhism, one studies oneself. When one studies oneself, one forgets oneself. When one forgets oneself, one is enlightened by everything. If this is the case, we stop being the way we sometimes view ourselves, as being this little somebody who lives in here somewhere. And then there's all the rest of you, and there's all the rest of everything else. Dogen is telling us that when we study oneself, we forget oneself. We forget the delusion that we're this little helpless thing just trying to find out what to do. We begin to realize that actually there's something much, much bigger. And when we live in the place of acknowledging that something bigger, I mean, the question of, I don't know what to do, almost becomes somewhat foolish if seen from that perspective. But we're not used to seeing from that perspective, perhaps as much as we would like to. Today we recited the first three chapters of the Shishogi. The fourth one, I was hoping that we were going to do that one, because the fourth one talks about true wisdom. It talks about it in terms of the four wisdoms. And this is interesting because, you know, the mind that wants to know how to fix things would never think of any of these things. The four wisdoms, charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy, are the means we have of helping others. Not figuring out what someone should do. Charity is the opposite of covetousness. We make offerings although we ourselves get nothing whatsoever. To help someone else, I don't know what to do with this child. The mind that wants to control the child's behavior isn't really concerned with would be the means of helping them. It's more us. To behold all beings with the eye of compassion and to speak kindly to them is the meaning of tenderness. Instead of an argument, tenderness. It may not solve the immediate question, but it helps create something much, much larger. By praising those who exhibit virtue and feeling sorry for those who do not, our enemies become our friends, and they who are our friends have their friendship strengthened. This is all through the power of tenderness. No arguments. Tenderness. If one creates wise ways of helping beings, whether they be in high places or lowly stations, one exhibits benevolence. The stupid believe that they will lose something if they give help to others. But this is completely untrue, for benevolence helps everyone. If one can identify oneself with that which is not oneself, one can understand the true meaning of sympathy. Sympathy is as the sea in that it never refuses water from whatsoever source it may come. All waters may gather and form only one sea. So, if we're willing to consider not knowing, at times when everything is crying out that we need to know what to do about something, the answer perhaps lies not in knowing, but in ways of being, because those four wisdoms are not teaching you how to do anything. They're offering alternate ways of being. So when we don't know what to do, the first thing that we need to do is sit still and try to see clearly what or who it is that's right in front of us. Not who I am, what I want, what I need, what is it that is right before me. And then we need to sit still and listen. And if it's right, take one step. Go back to bed, Liz. You know, we don't need to find ultimate solutions. And then we need to keep sitting still and listening and take one more step. So we need to practice not knowing in order to get away from the fears of not knowing what to do. Not knowing.